Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Dr. Nolan Higdon. On today's program, we will discuss how critical theory can help us analyze Trump's America with our guests, Dr. Bill Usman and Dr. Lori Bindig Usman from Sacred Heart University in Connecticut. Please stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm Dr. Nolan Higdon in studio with my co-hosts Amy Casey and Dr. Nicholas Bayham III. We are once again broadcasting from lovely Hayward, California. And I want to remind our listeners, we will be at the College of Marin October 26th, 27th, 2018 for the annual Project Censored Conference. Come on out. Come see us. All of us from the radio are going to be here. Mitch is going to be there. Amy, Desiree, myself, Nick will all be there hanging out. And we'd love to meet the listeners, hang out with you guys, see what you think about the show. And just chat it up. Again, that's October 26, 27, 2018 at College of Marin in the lovely San Francisco Bay Area. Amy, you're here to tell us more.
This is Amy Casey with the Media Freedom Foundation. On today's program, we will discuss how critical theory can help us analyze Trump's America with our guests Dr. Bill Usman and Dr. Lori Bindig Usman from Sacred Heart University in Connecticut. At this time, I would like to remind our listeners that every Friday you can get the latest Project Censored show before it hits the airwaves. Just go to www.projectcensored.org/radio. There you can listen to any and all of the Project Censored shows and show your support for Project Censored. Please rate and like us on iTunes. It is a big help. If you like the Project Censored show and the free content we provide, just hit like on iTunes. Any feedback that you have for the show, questions, comments, concerns, can be directed to Twitter. Nolan can be found at Nolan_Higdon. Dr. Bayham can be found at Dr. Dreadlocks. And Desiree can be found at Des_Blacktivist.
All right. Thank you, Amy. So we set up the show. One thing I wanted to talk about right away was I've been going to these conferences and I'm watching television shows like Roseanne and I watch Trump's Twitter feed. And all I keep hearing is about the 2016 election. And I'm starting to think it's like this zombie that won't die, right? So that's the mindset I'm in. I'm like, I'm going to come into the show. We're going to talk about this. And this whole discussion I wanted to have about validating the different sides of this debate between Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton and Trump and all these things. And then I looked down at my phone while driving because I'm from California and that's what we do. And I noticed that the Democratic Party is suing Russia for conspiring in the 2016 presidential election.
I have to say I'm surprised, but I'm not surprised.
Yeah, so this says the Democratic Party sued Russia as well as President Trump's campaign and WikiLeaks, charging that they conspired to disrupt the 2016 presidential election. Party alleges in this federal lawsuit in Manhattan that the Trump campaign officials conspired with the Russian government and its military spy agency to hurt the Democratic presidential nominee Hillary Clinton and tilt the election toward Trump by hacking the Democratic Party computers. The lawsuit also names Donald Trump Jr., Trump associate Roger Stone, and Trump's son-in-law Jared Kushner as defendants. And the lawsuit alleges that Trump's campaign gleefully welcomed Russia's help in the 2016 election.
Wow. That's really all I can say at this point. Like you said, it won't die. It feels like a Groundhog Day that just will not end.
And I have this growing concern as a liberal that the Democrats are still fighting 2016. They're still trying to argue they lost the election because of fraud and that Trump is bad. And I don't disagree. I find Trump abhorrent. But I'm worried you're going to run in 2018 and 2020 on we're not Trump. And he's in the process of pulling what I would call his actual Trump card, which is war. This country rallies around war. If you're an anti-war candidate, they jump against you. Look what happened to John Kerry. You can look back at political parties from the past, including the Whig Party or what happened to the Democrats when they were anti-Vietnam in the 70s. This country jumps against anyone who opposes war, and they jump right behind anybody who's for war. So if you're not Trump and you don't have any policies that excite people, meanwhile, he's exciting people with war, I'm very concerned what's going to happen in 2018 and 2020, despite what all the polls are showing.
Oh, definitely. And as you said, everyone seems to rally around that war aspect, good versus evil. It just seems to be a concept that is so divisive and so fluid in the media narratives that no one wants to let it go. That's how you pull in the viewers, is either side, really. Of course, you have the warmongering on one, but then that's the Democratic standpoint against it is, oh, well, that's not us. Even though if you look at President Obama's presidency, there was quite a few acts of not declared war, but something a little more sinister, a little
drone
more
strikes.
Yeah, exactly. That wasn't really politicized in the media.
No, absolutely. So I'm really concerned about this, but this lawsuit means this will continue to drag on, just the Russia investigation has. And by the way, for the record, our listeners, if they find out that Russia actually did do these things and did tilt the election, I'm 100% behind it. My fear is that the Democratic Party are putting all their eggs in the Russia basket, and it may not pay off, rather than finding solutions to excite people.
Boom, bing, bing, bing. Wah. Bing, clink, hello. Bye, bing.
But Bernie, but I'm concerned, too, about the rift between these Hillary supporters and Bernie supporters. So we're going to talk with Bill Usman and Lori Bendig Usman later, and I want to talk about the Roseanne program. And one of the things about the Roseanne program, right, is there's a fight between her and her sister, and her sister was a Hillary supporter, and Roseanne's a Trump supporter, and they still haven't talked in some amount of time since the election, right? That's kind of the premise of the show. It's actually real, though. This is happening. I went to a conference in February, and I was surprised. The Hillary supporters and Bernie supporters are still fighting and debating what happened in 2016, which is fine to debate the politics of it, but it's personal. Like, they've created these camps. I'm going to propose a therapy session.
And I'm going to help people. Because I'm good enough, I'm smart enough, and doggone it, people like me.
That's what I'm doing.
Mandatory.
Yes, it's a mandatory therapy session. It's about validation. I think the Bernie supporters, they need to hear that you guys know the Democratic Party worked with Hillary to fix the election.
Well, and it's hard, too, because you want to be sympathetic and empathetic, but it's not anything new in politics. This idea that you work against your own party after a certain point to get a certain official elected. Nothing new, but there tends to be an outcry that it is something entirely new that we've never encountered before. But now it's just in the spotlight.
And I think it's validation on each side. I think the Bernie supporters just need to hear that the Democratic Party did work against him. They need to say, wasn't this Bernie bros attack and racist attack were really unfair to Bernie? They need to hear Hillary supporters say that, look, we still support you on things like fighting against unjust wars and fighting against the prison industrial complex, but voting for a woman was more important to us in this election. That's all. Just need to say that.
Mm-hmm.
But the Bernie supporters also need to validate the Hillary supporters. They don't think it was fair she was compared absolutely the same to Trump, or that some of these supporters refused to vote at all or vote for a third party candidate. So I think we just need a therapy session. If you could just come together on the left.
We just need a group hug, a little kumbaya.
That's
we'll
right.
Be good to go.
We need some of that Berkeley free speech love thing. Maybe it's the 420 that's getting to me. I don't know.
Feeling the love.
That's right. Everything feels so great. Okay. Well, when we come back, we are going to talk to Dr. Bill Usman and Dr. Lori Bendig about their new book. And we are also going to talk about issues of critical theory and how it can be applied to Trump's America. We'll be back after this short musical break.
We'll be right back.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm Dr. Nolan Higdon in studio with my co-host, Dr. Nicholas Baham III and Amy Casey. Amy, who do we have on the show?
Today's guests are Dr. Bill Usman and Dr. Lori Bindig Usman. Dr. Bill Usman earned his doctorate in communication from the University of Massachusetts Amherst. His area of focus is critical media studies. He is the former managing director of the Media Education Foundation and the current director of the graduate program in media literacy, communication, and media arts. Bill's research focuses on media literacy education and the construction of racial ideologies in media images and narratives. He has published numerous essays in peer-reviewed journals and anthologies. His first book, Primetime Prisons on U.S. Television, Representation of Incarceration, was published in 2009. The Spike Lee Enigma, Challenge and Incorporation in Media Culture, was published in 2014. He is also the co-editor of Gender, Race, and Class in Media, 5th edition, which was recently published in 2018. Dr. Lori Bindig Usman earned her doctorate in communication at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, where she was awarded the title of University Fellow as an incoming student in 2004. She is an associate professor in the School of Communication and Media Arts at Sacred Heart University. Her research interests include cultural studies, critical television studies, and media literacy, with a focus on the construction and commodification of young femininity. Lori is the co-author of The OC, A Critical Understanding, and the author of Dawson's Creek, A Critical Understanding, as well as Gossip Girl, A Critical Understanding, published by Lexington Books. She is the co-editor of Gender, Race, and Class in Media, 5th edition, which was recently published in 2018. Welcome, Dr. Usman.
How are you guys?
Hi.
Hi, how's it going?
Going well. Good to hear your guys' voices.
Yeah, happy to be here.
We definitely want to talk about your book, Gender, Race, and Class in Media. I've been recommending it to everyone. I think it's a great book for educators to use. Also, you guys have so many resources that come with it. But I also think for the general public, I think it's just a great book for understanding. I've been recommending it to people who seem to be mystified why people are talking about race and gender and class so often. So I pick up the book. It tells us a lot about it. Would you mind telling our listeners a little bit about what the book entails?
Sure. So Bill and I were really fortunate to come on as the new editors of Gender, Race, and Class in Media for the 5th edition. It had been established by two other previous scholars back in 1995, and they created it to be the first anthology that took a critical media literacy approach to the issues of gender, race, and class in media. And so they built this wonderful tradition of scholarship in this area, finding the best reading that dealt with these topics from this multicultural and critical media literacy perspective. They recently brought Bill and I on to carry on this work, and we're just thrilled about it.
I think when a lot of people hear about books like this, they kind of wonder how relevant the reading will be. Can you talk about some of the essays that are in there that I think will really be relevant to maybe people's consumption habits or political leanings?
I think in general, the impetus behind the book is that media play a crucial role in shaping how we understand things like gender, race, class, and that we can't take popular culture for granted because it is such a huge part of how we come to it. It provides a lens for how we see the world. The whole notion behind the book is let's realize that media is much more than just entertainment. And let's take a serious look at how things like the portrayal of women on television may help to shape people's expectations about what the women in their lives encounter on a regular basis. For example, there's a new chapter in this new edition of the book by a scholar named Rosemary Pennington, which takes on Katy Perry. Now, people might say, Katy Perry, she's just a pop star. How could you possibly write seriously about Katy Perry? But what this chapter does is it looks at how certain performances and music videos by Katy Perry portray a sense of people of other races and from other parts of the world as these exotic others who are just so mysterious and inscrutable is the old phrase that was used. And that in this video, in her video, those types of misleading ideas are reified. Another chapter by Jackson Katz, who is a great scholar writing about masculinity, looks at how conservative talk radio actually laid the groundwork for Donald Trump's ascent to office, because Donald Trump is kind of the political manifestation of who Rush Limbaugh was as a media manifestation. Other chapters take a look at the role of advertising in shaping how we understand sexuality. They take a look at what new media, the internet, and social media do to shape how we interact with media and how we see each other. There's a chapter by Andrea Braithwaite about the Gamergate scandal, which happened a few years ago, where women in the gaming industry were being subjected to these really horrible misogynistic attacks. So that's just kind of a taste of what the content is about.
We spend a lot of time on the Project Censored show talking about news media, but just to expand what our listeners hear, you talked about this portrayal of women in entertainment media and how it's not apolitical. So can you kind of discuss what accounts for these portrayals? Maybe you could use the Katy Perry example, or if you have others, what accounts for these portrayals of women?
I think that there's a lot that goes into how women are represented in media. The media industry, from a production aspect, are not as prevalent as they should be, that it is still very much a man's world. And so how women are portrayed, they're portrayed through that lens, that their experiences, their voices often don't make their way into the writer's room. And then when you layer things like race and class onto that, you're getting these very fragmented, very stereotyped versions of various people and identities, whether it's women or people of color, because of how the production is set up. And then we have to understand that we're part of a commercial media system, and we want these representations that are light, that are fluffy, that you can then sell toothpaste in during the ad break.
So what do you, just curiosity, there's been a lot of talk recently about the revival of the show Roseanne, and I'm wondering, with your guys' analysis, especially with the in terms of the gender, race, and class book, have you guys had a chance to watch these new episodes of Roseanne? Do you have any thoughts on the show?
Full disclosure, I haven't actually watched it. Take all of that into account. What's troubling for me about the show, actually, though, is not about the content of the show itself, but it's about what Roseanne Barr herself has become, and how, despite the fact that she really has kind of transformed herself into this social media troll who is not just complicit, but is actively disseminating false, misleading, and blatant lies that are supportive of the lies of the Trump administration, this is what she's actually doing in her own life. This is who she actually is. And then you combine that with a program that then provides a sympathetic portrayal of a person like that. And I think that's very troubling. I think there should be some connection made between who Roseanne Barr has actually become and some of the destructive things that she's doing, and her still being given this really powerful platform in order to continue disseminating really misleading conceptions.
Okay, so you see it as like art imitating life in Roseanne's case?
Well, I think it's art imitating this fiction of life, because I think she's writing like this real fiction about what really happened in the last election. One of the big myths about this last election is that Donald Trump represented the voice of the working class. Well, first of all, if you actually look at the demographics of who supported Trump and who supported Clinton, Trump had a higher percentage of support from the wealthy, and Clinton had a higher percentage of support from people who make less than the poverty line. That type of misleading idea drains race out of the picture. Trump had higher support amongst the white working class, not against the working class as a whole. And it seems like whenever we talk about the working class, we picture white people, when actually large percentages of the working class are people of color. And I think that that type of misleading myth is reinforced and promulgated by what Roseanne Barr is doing, both in her own personal life and what she's doing on this show. Let's not forget, Roseanne Barr is a mega wealthy Hollywood superstar. Her support for Trump is not the support of the working class. Her character's support might be, but again, it's based on a fiction.
Bill, this is Amy Casey, by the way. Thank you for joining us. I think you're really hitting the nail on the head, because media consumption and popular culture in general tends to maintain the current power structures while presenting a facade of challenging them. And I know that your work, Lori, especially with the latest gender, race, and class in media, that's as true now, yesterday, as it will be tomorrow, and it was 50 years ago, and it is today. What are your thoughts on truly challenging narratives in the mainstream using popular culture?
I think it is possible to do that. I think that the Black Panther movie, for example, which became such a really huge success, one of the most widely anticipated and then widely embraced Hollywood films ever, I think that's an example of a film that really does ask some critical questions about not just race, but about the destructive nature of imperial power and what the United States has done to other parts of the world. You may have varying perspectives on how the American character in that film was represented, but there's no question that it makes us think, and it asks these really difficult questions about what role has the American empire played throughout the world, and what should be the proper response from that, from colonized people. That, to me, was a fascinating example of popular culture that asks us to think critically and that asks us to think beyond our facile notions of race and class, whereas I think that's more of a rarity, unfortunately, in the popular culture that we usually get.
And I would say that this goes back and speaks to whose stories get told, who has the power to tell these stories, because with Black Panther, we had more diverse casting involved. Obviously, is it perfect? No, it's a huge Marvel major motion picture, but that does also help in getting something that's a little bit more challenging out to the general public.
All right, we are talking to Dr. Bill Usman and Dr. Lori Bendig Usman. We're talking about their new book, Gender, Race, and Class in Media, 5th edition. And we're going to continue our conversation with them. I want to talk about some of their recommendations and some of their viewing habits after we return from this short musical break. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm Dr. Nolan Higdon in studio with my co-hosts Amy Casey and Dr. Nicholas Baham III. We are lucky enough to be joined by Dr. Bill Usman and Dr. Lori Bindig Usman talking about their new book, Gender, Race, and Class in Media. And we've been talking about some of the content and some of the ways that we should experience and view this content. And I wondered two questions I want to ask you guys. One is, do you guys enjoy watching television or do you find it just to be a mundane research activity? And then based on that, what recommended viewing habits would you send out to some of our listeners?
Well, Nolan, I'm going to tackle the first part of that. I have to say, believe it or not, I absolutely love media. I love watching media. I love going to the movies. I love reading about it. I love researching it. I know some people would say that critical viewing habits or critical media literacy changes the way that you watch or consume media. And that is true. You don't watch the same. You're paying attention to so much more. But to me, that just makes the experience so much richer. Most of the time, unless I'm watching something I really don't want to watch for a very specific reason, I absolutely enjoy and embrace it. But that doesn't mean that I'm not critiquing it, that I'm not seeing often large-scale problems.
Do you guys have any sort of recommended viewing habits for our listeners? Things to maybe consider as soon as they sit down to watch a program or enjoy a program or movie? God, well, I sounded so old the way I just said program. Did you guys hear that?
You really dated yourself there.
I did, didn't I? Television program. Sorry, but go ahead, you guys.
Probably the first thing is that we should get away from our screens sometimes. You know, I'm not one of these people who believes that we shouldn't use any screen media at all. I think that's an unrealistic perspective. I think it doesn't take into account the realities of the world that we're living in. But I do think there's the danger of using screen media to the exclusion of other types of cultural experiences. I'm a big fan of books. I think books are really important, and one of the things I worry most about is that people are doing a lot less reading of books. I know people are reading online, but I don't think that that's the same type of reading. And again, at the risk of just sounding like an old buddy, I think there's something really important about picking up a book and reading it from cover to cover. It's an immersive experience that I think opens the world up to us in ways that we are diminished people if we don't have that experience. While I'm not anti-screen media, and like Lori, I get a lot of enjoyment out of watching television and movies, both for my own academic work and again and just for pleasure. I think that does have to be put into balance with other types of media consumption. So that's probably the first thing that I would say.
I think the second thing, and I very much agree with Bill, we're both people that have tons of books piled everywhere in our office, on our nightstands, in our home. But when we do sit down to watch a television program or a film, I think not just accepting things at face value, really thinking about, oh, what is this film really saying about gender or race or class or sexuality or even consumption? There are some TV shows and films that all it is product placement or glamorous lifestyle after glamorous lifestyle. When we see those images, not letting them just wash over us and just accepting them, but thinking for a second, taking a step back and saying, what is this really saying? What is the underlying message of this film, this television show? Just like you would if you were analyzing a poem, not just taking the poem at face value, but what is the underlying meaning to this poem? Doing the same thing with our popular media content.
Oh, thank you, Lori and Bill. Well, you just compliment each other so well. I actually had a two-part question, and you both answered it, but I wanted to see if you had any additional thoughts. Bill, for you, I know that you advocate the printed media, the book medium. I do as well. I collect them. I hoard them. I love them. And on-screen media tends to be something more tangible to the viewer and easy to consume. I view it as an oversimplification of a complex topic. Now, I know that only so much can be covered in any given frame at any given moment of screen media. And to compliment you, Lori, I really loved the questions that you presented to the audience that you can sit there and ask, what, engaging yourself in that screen media, who was being represented and why. Do you have any specific go-to questions that no matter what, your students, yourself, those are the first questions that you should ask yourself during consumption?
I think it's important to look at media from four different grand perspectives. I think what we're used to is focusing just on the content of media, and I do think that that's important. So the first thing I would say is ask critical questions about the content. How are people being portrayed? What stereotypes might you see being played out? What is the power relationships between the people on the screen? What underlying messages might be there? Also, what's not there? What's being left out? Whose stories aren't being told? What perspectives are we not being introduced to? So that's looking at the actual content of media. But then I think we also need to go beyond that. And we need to look at the production practices of media. And we need to look at that both in terms of who is creating the media that we're using, what might their agenda be, how is that media being funded. There was this scandal about Sinclair Broadcasting making all of their anchors read the same type of propaganda content. That's a question not so much of content, but of who is Sinclair Broadcasting? What is this institution? What are their goals? What are they trying to do to us? And how have they become such a huge, powerful media corporation? So I think also looking at what we call the political economy of media is really important. I think in terms of how media is produced, I think we also need to look at the technologies that are used. What are the differences between, I brought up books versus television. What is the difference between social media and other types of media technologies? And then moving toward that fourth area, what is the impact on the people who are using the media? Asking questions about the audience. How are both the technologies and the content making an impact in our lives? How are we interpreting that content? So I think looking at it from that full spectrum approach of political economy, the media texts and messages themselves, the audiences and the technologies, I think that's the way into what we would call kind of a critical media literacy approach that isn't just something to be talked about in the classroom, but is something that we can integrate into our entire lives.
You guys have mentioned a lot about books, and I think it'd be good for our listeners. And I just like this a lot whenever I'm listening to things while driving around, because I live in the San Francisco Bay Area, and that's all we do is drive around and then die. But I like driving when I'm driving around to hear book recommendations. So I'm wondering, do you guys have any recent books you read that you would recommend to the audience that you thought was good, intriguing reads?
Besides our books, are you looking for fiction or nonfiction, Nolan?
Whatever you think.
I just finished Celeste Ng's, this is fiction, Little Fires Everywhere, which is actually going to be produced by Kerry Washington and Reese Witherspoon for a Hulu series. And I think it's going to be very interesting to see how they translate this story to screen. But it's very much a story, believe it or not, about gender, race, and class. Who would have thought? And so I think it's a very interesting read, and it does make us question some of our beliefs, these common sense beliefs about gender, race, and class in our lived experiences, even just thinking about it from motherhood or as a high school student. And so I definitely recommend that.
two recent nonfiction books that I just read both dealt with the 2016 election, which is, I think, one is called How Democracies Die by Stephen Levitsky and Daniel Ziblatt, who are political scientists. And they try to put what's happening in the United States right now into a larger, both historical and international context to dispel the myth that somehow American democracy is just naturally and automatically eternal and doesn't have to be defended. And then the other book that I finished just last week, I really, really loved. It's by a journalist that I like named Steve Almond, and it's called Bad Stories, What the Hell Just Happened to Our Country? And his argument is that Trump's ascendancy was really rooted in what he calls bad stories that we've been telling ourselves for decades now. He calls them bad stories. I might call them myths that we have about our country, myths that we have about power, myths that we have about relationships that we just kind of take for granted and don't look at from a critical perspective. I think that's a great place to start. And Amon's book, Bad Stories, it really is a book about media literacy as well, even though he doesn't use that phrase.
All right, we are talking to Dr. Bill Usman and Dr. Lori Bindig-Usman about their book, Gender, Race, and Class in Media. We just about 30 seconds left, but where can people go to get a copy of the fifth edition? Should we just send them to Amazon, or?
It's convenient. The publisher is Sage Publishing, and I think you can order copies directly from their website. There's also Powell's. Powell's.com is an online bookseller, and I would go to your local independent bookstore and ask them to order a copy for you through Amazon. Sorry.
All right, Bill and Lori, it's always a pleasure talking to you two. You guys are fascinating. Thanks very much for coming on the Project Censored Show.
All right, great talking to you too, Ellen. Can't wait to see you.
All right, we'll be back after this short musical break. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm Dr. Nolan Higdon in studio with my co-hosts, Amy Casey and Dr. Nicholas Bayham III. and we are joined by Sage Healy. Sage Healy is a senior at University of San Francisco. He is majoring in media studies. Sage Healy is part of a student-faculty effort to create a fake news documentary working for the Media Freedom Foundation. And so we've been trying to bring students in the studio every week to talk about the work they're doing, why they find it important, etc. So, Sage, tell us, what sparked your interest in working on this fake news documentary for the Media Freedom Foundation?
Fake news has a very big impact on democratic communications, and what we're trying to do is expose that. We're asking prominent professors in areas of independent, mainstream, and corporate news media how fake news is generated, why it's generated, and how it affects societal institutions, systems, and structures.
You are fake news.
I love that sounder.
What's the work you've done so far? So you've been doing some recording and interviewing. Can you tell us a little bit about like what you've been recording, who you've been interviewing, how the interviews have been constructed, and sort of how you're working with other students? So kind of talk about that process.
I'm working with a group of interns. We are filming interviews with professors. We're also filming interviews with students who have insights on fake news.
Okay, and the students are in charge of setting up like the lighting and the audio and all that kind of stuff, right?
We're doing the lighting, we're doing the audio, we're doing the filming, we're doing everything.
Okay, yeah, this is kind of cool. So for our listeners who have been listening the last couple of weeks, I mean, multi-campuses, each campus is going to have students working on campus, recording educators, recording students, getting footage of the campuses to kind of show this effort, not only fake news exists and its problems, but also how education is being used to combat it, right?
Right. Professors are talking about how to fight fake news. That's the working title, Fighting Fake News.
You interviewed Dr. Dorothy Kidd, right, at University of San Francisco?
Yes, Dr. Kidd.
What were some of the things that Dr. Dorothy Kidd said about fake news and as well as the efforts to combat it?
Dr. Kidd had a lot of insights on how fake news is spread, the political economy behind fake news, who's spreading it, why they're spreading it, and more so on how to teach students and basically society about how to interpret and how to analyze fake news compared to real news.
Yeah, and I always had to ask this of students. The idea behind this documentary, right, is to make a free documentary available online for people to consume and learn more about these topics and solutions. Prior to working on this, would you say, and you're looking back high school and middle school, did you get a lot of exposure to the problems with news media, where news media lies and falsehoods in news media, or was that something you didn't get to college?
That wasn't something I got to until college, until my higher education.
I always think that's interesting, right? It's something revealing. We live in this most mediated society in human history, and yet we have no program to teach individuals about the dangers associated with media. Dr. Bayham, you must teach a lot of this in the classroom, right?
I do a little bit. I'm kind of curious for you personally, how do you consume media? And I'm just wondering, there obviously folks of my generation constantly bemoan the absence of the newspaper, which used to, certainly when I was a kid, the notion was that part of your education was to read a newspaper. And we were always encouraged as kids to go to a library, get in the newspaper room, and read newspapers from around the country, or if they're foreign newspapers that you can read those, as well as other print media. We're in a different age now. But I'm wondering, first of all, how you consume media for the most part, and do you have any sentimentality, if you will, with respect to print media and the demise of print media in this country?
I carefully pick which news organizations I adhere to. I find that with my education background, I know some organizations are more leaning to the right, more left. I try to situate myself in the middle. I try to find good investigative reporting. With regards to print media, I can't say that I read the newspaper because
okay.
I don't.
And I guess my follow-up question to this is, as a younger person, I'm wondering if you have any, based on some of the courses maybe you've taken or whatever, if you have any sense of that innocent, quote-unquote, more innocent age that we grew up in the media, where we would turn on, we'd see Walter Cronkite or someone like that, and we would just assume that we were getting facts. Family would sit and watch 60 Minutes on Sunday, and you assume that that was hard investigative journalism. Do you have a sense of that quote-unquote innocent period that some of us believe that we went through?
I think in good, hard investigative journalism still exists. It's just harder to find.
Mm-hmm.
It's not out. You can't turn on Channel 3 and tune in to good, hard investigative reporting. You have to go out and seek it.
Mm-hmm.
I like Vice News a lot.
I think
they do a good job.
All right. Interesting.
And I think Sage brings up an interesting point, too, about reaching out to the other side. So I always did this by reading things like the Wall Street Journal and Forbes to kind of hear what right-wing media was talking about. And sometimes I would listen to O'Reilly or Hannity just to figure out.
You lost some brain cells doing that, you know.
I did.
Yes. Sorry.
It's okay. I'm still in recovery. But it's good to know, because especially like an educator, you get things in your classroom out of nowhere, and you're just like, wait, where did you hear that? Like, what are we talking about? I have no clue when they mention some things. But I've also recently tried to add in what I call maybe like more responsible right-wing critics. So people who believe right-wing ideology or right-wing politics, but are more responsible, right? Like a David Frum or an Andrew Sullivan, where I don't agree with them and they have problems, but I can at least understand sort of where their rationale is going. And I think that's important as well, to kind of give you a perspective of where the right is, to give them that fair shake so you can debate people. So I think that's somewhat responsible. Would you agree with that, Nick?
Yeah, I would. I was going to also ask you, too, talking about various forms of media here and new technology, Vice. I have a 14-year-old, and he's deeply into podcast world. For example, listening to his dad on Patreon, which I'm flattered by. Is the podcast space also something that's attractive to you? And have you managed to ferret out news media that is more fact-based on podcast? I mean, aside from this show.
Right. I like NPR a lot. I think they do a good job. For as far as podcasts go, I would say NPR, PBS, those two I listen to a lot.
Yes. Okay. Does any of that bother you? I mean, the corporatization of that, sounding like an old man here really talking to you about the glory days of media. And I'm not really sure that they were exactly the glory days of media now in retrospect, because we were always slowly headed towards this. But I think there was a notion at some point in time that we keep the corporations out of media. That media, that especially news, didn't need to be something that produced profit. It didn't have to have revenue. It was basically something that you were going to lose money on. But with the pulling away of funding, public television as well as and public radio have had to rely on corporate sponsors. I'm just kind of wondering if that troubles you at all.
Well, it does trouble me. And we've just seen this with St. Clair Broadcasting Company. They pretty much own, across the board, 50 to 100 stations.
Yes.
And their ownership, they are giving certain scripts that the anchors have to say, or they'll get fired. And also, they sign contracts within the St. Clair Broadcasting Company. So if you want to opt out, you end up getting charged, and you also can't work in the industry anymore.
Interesting. Yeah. Yeah, I know personally, I'm very troubled by the fact that I have been finding myself rooting for the Washington Post in the battle against Donald Trump. And I find that a little bit odd. I'm essentially rooting for the Amazon Post. And that is wholly troubling to me in so many respects, that my life is, to a degree, my political sensibilities have been about cheering for one billionaire versus another supposed billionaire.
I'm really rich.
There you go.
The battle of the billionaires. Where
right, the battle of the billionaires.
Everybody is a loser.
Right.
All right. Sage, thank you very much for coming in today and talking about the documentary. And hopefully we'll have you in the next couple of weeks coming back and checking in with us.
All right. Thank you.
Amy Casey is here to tell us more about how you can get in touch with the Project Censored Show.
This is Amy Casey with the Media Freedom Foundation, and I would like to remind you that every Friday you can get the latest Project Censored show before it hits the airwaves. Just go to www.projectcensored.org/radio. There, you can listen to any and all of the Project Censored shows, as well as show your support for Project Censored. We are also on iTunes now, so please pop over, give us a rate, and like us. It is a big, big help to the organization. If you like the Project Censored show and the free content that we provide, just hit like on iTunes. Your feedback is also very much requested. Compliments, questions, concerns, topics, anything you want, we want to hear it. Your feedback can be directed to Twitter. Nolan can be found at Nolan_Higdon. Nick can be found at Dr. Dreadlocks, and Desiree can be found at Des_Blacktivist.
All All right. Thank you very much. I want to remind our listeners again, October 26, 27, 2018, come out to College of Marin. Come hang out with us. And if any of you are in Chicago, I will be in Chicago May 10th and 11th. I will be attending the Union for Democratic Communications Conference. So come on out. If you're in Chicago, let me know. Hit me up on Twitter. Love to see you guys. All right. You've been listening to the Project Censored Show. I'm Dr. Nolan Higdon in studio with my co-hosts, Nicholas Baham III and Amy Casey. It's been a great show today, by the way.
Oh, wonderful.
Mickey Huff and Peter Phillips are executive producers and hosts. Give a big thank you out to Dr. Bill Usman and Dr. Lori Bendig-Usman, our guests, as well as Sage Healy. It's always great to have the students in here, a reminder of the great work we do at the Media Freedom Foundation. Always a pleasure. Mitch Scorza is our director and engineer and also our comedian sound guy, as we've heard throughout the program. The Project Censored Show airs on over 40 stations around the U.S., from Maui to Manhattan and all over the internet. You can get us all over the podcast world. Please follow us and like us on Facebook. Also, talk to us on Twitter and visit our website at projectcensored.org, where you can listen to all the radio shows for the past 7 years, as well as read 40-plus years of news that didn't make the news. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time.
Conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, cause they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign. That's why you hear the same old things they claim, but change never came. It's a dirty game maintained by rain for capital gain, but my people getting tired of the pain and the shame. We're not commodities or cogs that turn the global economy. We're the promise of a legacy, a spirit we're honoring. An anomaly to those who can't imagine a world without oppressive force, a slave and for almighty. Political ties, habitual lies, alibis, skies, another guy's democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison. Genocide, wars, fall for little boys, and the weapons manufactured paid for by taxing while the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons, build the capacity, citizens, in the times for the master thief. Divine and conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out the reach, all potential fame at the table, then you're probably on the menu.